Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
MSW Media.
All right, so we are live here. What we're drinking is the podcast. Dan Dunn, a gentleman and a scholar. We honor his time. He's been a great man, a gracious host. We love you all to death. We'll see you soon. Zinky McGinky, take care.
A glass, sit for a spill. It's time to have some fun. Let's do a little thinking, some picking and a drinking. But this is what we're drinking with Dan Dunn.
Very exciting day for me on the show because I don't always have a co-host, but today I do. All the way in from Chattanooga, Tennessee, you know her, you love her, she's been on the show before, Ash McHugh.
Hello, how are you?
It's so good that you flew in for this because always. This is such a special show we're doing today. It is. We're coming to you today from a location unlike any we've ever broadcast from on What We're Drinking. A $69 million, I guess that's a mansion, right? A state?
Yeah. Mega mansion.
Compound, state, yeah. Compound, in yeah. Bel Air, Castle. California, yeah. And what, pray tell, are we doing here in such a lavish locale? Well, that has everything to do with the guest whose voice you just heard. He is one of the very top luxury real estate agents in the world. In the world.
That's a stretch. Maybe in my neighborhood.
His neighborhood. Yeah, that's the world for luxury real estate.
Okay, fair enough.
And he stars on the hit Netflix series Buying Beverly Hills. Also has a YouTube show called Liquidated Damages, where he gets to indulge one of his great passions. We're going to do that today as well. Wine. I'm right there with you, buddy.
Yeah.
Please welcome to the show, John Grauman. How are you, buddy?
Let's clap it up here. Yes. Thank you. Thank you very much. Really good to be here.
It's really good to see you, man. I feel like we know each other because earlier this week I turned on Buying Beverly Hills and I thought, you know, I'll skim through and just get an idea who John is. And 8 hours later, I watched
that.
The entire first season in one day. I got hooked.
Binge watching. That's the newest rage. It's what everybody does. You sit down for what you think is going to be an episode before you know it. It's dark outside.
It's crazy. Yeah. I mean, it's like, you know, say like real estate porn, right? I mean,
yeah,
you're 100%. Watching, and it's not a world that I'm very familiar with.
Right.
I, you know, money, big houses, any of that stuff, right? But I'm watching the show, and I'll be honest, normally I would probably be bothered by it, but I loved the show, and I thought you guys had such a great vibe on it, and you especially, because there's a lot of gossiping and a little bit backbiting going on, but you kind of stayed above the fray. Is that normally how it is, or just because of the show?
No, that's definitely an accurate portrayal of me, and that's frankly one of the things I was most concerned about when I agreed to participate in the show, is being portrayed accurately and not getting sort of, you know, sucked up in what can be oftentimes the sort of, you know, gossipy cattiness that you associate with most reality shows. You know, for me, the show is kind of broken out into two parts, as you saw, right? There's the relationship between Mauricio and his daughters and the dynamic of them working together. And then there's, you know, they wanted to try to put a different spin on a real estate reality show and show what it's like through the eyes of a true rookie agent, an actual brand new agent to the industry. And how do they make it in this highly competitive, contentious, cutthroat industry? Well, every mentee needs a mentor. So that's where I step in. So the nice part about my involvement in the show is that I kind of just get sprinkled in to like drop some wisdom, give out some knowledge, and I'm gone. So I just kind of come in and provide the house porn, as you said, and give those big, beautiful backdrops, because that's really kind of how I had hoped to be involved, and I'm happy with the way it turned out.
And by the way, when you say Mauricio, you're talking about Mauricio Umansky.
Correct.
Who is the founder, CEO of the agency. That's the name. And then you have your own sort of subsection of that, the Grauman team.
Kind of, yes. So Mauricio, as you said, is the CEO and founder of a company called The Agency, which is the brokerage where I work. I, however, have my own group within that agency called Bond Collective. Bond Collective is the biggest real estate team at the agency and one of the biggest teams in the country. We did just shy of about $1.4 billion in sales last year, which certainly puts us as, you know, one of the top teams in the country. I don't know about the world, but certainly the country. So again, it's we got to showcase a lot of those really big, beautiful listings that we have the privilege of representing, such as one that I had for $139 million, which you saw in the finale, where Mauricio and I are sitting there having that scene together in the living room. So, you know, for a lot of people, we kind of have to pinch ourselves, right, that we actually get to tour through these homes as just part of our, like, daily occurrence. And we have to remind ourselves that most people will never see the inside of one of these big homes. Mm-hmm. You just don't have that opportunity. You're never be given that access. So it's fun to be able to kind of showcase that and invite people into those homes on camera.
That place, so you did sell it.
No, not sadly, okay. That one we haven't sold.
That was
no,
the one that has on that was the one that has the giant screen that comes up from behind the pool.
Yeah, 25-foot screen that comes up behind the pool.
It's almost incomprehensible. Like just when you see even the place. There was another house. Maybe it was in the last episode or the one before. The woman, I can't remember her name. The developer. It was about a $40 million home.
Oh sure, the one on Orem.
And it looked like it was on stilts, kind of.
Yeah,
even only 40 million. Like I'm looking at this and going, it's hard to imagine that there are people in the world that can go, yeah, I'll take that.
And that's one of the questions I probably get most is who buys these homes? How many people can afford these homes? And the answer is more than you would think, but still it's a fraction. It's a fraction of a tenth of a percentage of the world's population. Obviously you're talking about, you know, the smallest pond you can possibly be fishing in. But by the same token, it's more than you would think. We just listed a property last week for $28 million here in Bel Air. We had 7 showings in the first week. That means there's 7 qualified buyers in town, in the market for a $28 million home that think that particular home might be the right fit for them, right? There's a lot of different factors that come into play there. To have 7 showings within the first week on a $28 million house in what is supposedly a down market, again, look, I've born and raised in LA. I'm actually fifth generation from here. My family's steeped in old Hollywood history. My third cousin.
Were you Grauman? Is that Grauman?
Grauman's Chinese Theater.
When I brought that up the other day, and they said, "Oh, is he part of that family?" I said, "I didn't see that anywhere."
Sid Grauman was a cousin, and he obviously built Grauman's Chinese Theater. At the same time, one of my great grandfathers was the head of RKO Pictures, and the other one was the business manager for Dean Martin and Jerry Lewis.
Wow.
So very sort of steeped in old Hollywood history. Again, my family's been here forever, and I only say that to make the point that it never ceases to amaze me the astronomical amount of money that exists in this town.
It's great. I want to ask you this, Ash, because you live in Chattanooga. But first thing we got to do is we've been talking way too long.
I agree.
We're drinking.
Totally
so
agree.
So let's have a toast here with a little bit of white wine. We've got.
Cheers.
Cheers.
Thanks, we got some Kendall Jackson Grand Reserve Chardonnay. And as I teased earlier, John's passion is wine.
It is.
And so I want to get your thoughts on this. Is a 2020 Chardonnay, okay. Santa Barbara County. It's 100% Chard. What do you think?
That's nice.
I love it.
Yeah, that's really nice. Smooth, has some nice citrus notes to it. Not too buttery, not too oaky.
Yeah,
that's
93% French oak, 29% of that's new. Santa Barbara County is one of the coolest grape growing regions in California.
Sure.
So it does lend itself to growing Chardonnay.
It does.
Pinot Noir as well.
Pinot Noir and Chardonnay is typically what you're going to find.
And we're going to have some Pinot
region
as well. But
yeah.
What's funny is I don't know how much this wine costs. I know what the other two cost, but whatever it is. Great. Yeah. But I mean, do you factor that in and you're like, does it matter to you? Are you...
Price?
Okay, so I used to write for Rob Report, right?
Okay,
I was a
sure.
spirits writer and wine writer for Rob Report. And the philosophy there was I could go to them and say, hey, I found an amazing wine. It's $18. No. Immediately no, because it doesn't fit the brand. Now, are you into finding those value wines, or would you prefer to do...
I'm definitely into... the discovering more sort of off the beaten path, smaller production type of wineries. To me, it's all like it's in the thrill of the hunt, so to speak. Mm. So my wife and I go up to Napa frequently. We have a place up there. And for us, like, look, it's easy to just like go up and down Highway 29 and peel off where like all the big tour buses are. But that's like, if you can find it at your local market, then why would you even possibly waste your time there? To me, it's about finding, again, the more boutique production, cult-like wineries that are producing really killer juice, but they're only selling it direct to their mailing list, or they're only selling it direct to local customers, local restaurants, that maybe do, you know, 200-400 cases a year. That's my jam. That's what I try to search out.
I'm with you on that. I mean, you know, we're talking about Kendall Jackson here, first of all, like up there. So they sort of run the gamut, because then you've got like Cardinal, which is up in Napa.
Yep,
Chris
right
Carpenter,
on
winemaker there. He's phenomenal. I mean, those are 100-point wines, $250 a bottle if you can get it.
Yeah, about that.
Then you go over to Sonoma County, and they've got Verite.
Mm-hmm.
Again, 100-point wines. You better be on the mailing list in order to get them.
Yeah.
But it is that thing about it. You're so right. Like, there's something. I've always said this about wine being experiential, because people will say, you know, what's your favorite wine? I'm like, I don't know. I think wines are not only about the quality, got to be a quality wine, but it's also like, who are you with?
Yep.
Those are the wines you remember. Oh, we were at Bottle Rock and we were drinking this wine, and I was with one of my favorite people in the world at that time. And that wine is always going to be special to you.
It's a sensory experience through and through. You know, what oftentimes happens, you taste a wine at a winery, and maybe you've come from a couple other wineries, and maybe you're with some friends, and you're in this special mood, and you buy a case of it, you get home, you open, you go, this doesn't taste like what I remember, because you weren't in that same place, right? And it's everything from your surroundings, the people you're with, the setting, the mood, all of that, I think, is a sensory experience. But, you know, the fun thing about Napa is Napa has really become sort of a billionaire's playground.
Yes.
There's so much wealth up there, and so many people that made their fortunes in other avenues and then just decided that one of their passions was wine, so they wanted to start a winery. The beauty of that is that you got a lot of guys there that are just striving for excellence no matter the cost.
Yeah.
They're not looking to turn a profit. They probably never will turn a profit. They don't give a shit if they're.
Well, that was Jess Jackson. That was Jess Jackson made his money in another. I think it was in finance, I believe, but and then went up there, and it was the same thing. And then obviously his situation was different. Kendall Jackson actually did turn a profit.
Kendall Jackson,
a large
I would imagine, probably has a nice profit margin.
But it's funny you mentioned that, John. Is when we were talking off the air about my book American Wino, and that was exactly one of the things I learned. I drove around the entire United States, and I had wine in places where you would never think to have wine. You know, North Georgia, up by Louisiana, all these places. And I remember it was so magical being in a lot of these places, and the wineries were beautiful, and the people are cool, and I'm drinking with them, and I'm like, this is great. Then they sent me the wines later, try them at home, and I'm like, I don't know if this North Georgia wine's as good as I remember it when I was there. With the winemaker and hearing the stories of, like, why did you choose to put a winery here at the foot of the, is it Appalachian or Appalachian?
Man? Appalachian.
Okay, Appalachian, you know, right? Know. Yeah, you know. Yeah. Why would you choose to do that? And then when they tell you their story and about, I mean, I was in, there was a winery in Nebraska, Wyoming, okay? Family farm, going under, you know, being put out by big agriculture. And the kid goes to the University of Minnesota and learns how to make wine, turns the family farm into a winery. Wow. And I pull up, there's a double wide, right? Go in, this is in Western Wyoming. And there's cowboys, legit like 70-year-old cowboys hunkered up to these, you know, plastic stools Friday afternoon
drinking wine.
Wyoming wine. And it was magical. And now, would I ever go to Spago and say, hey, you got any wild wine here? They'd be like,
I
no.
That place.
It was great.
Cowboy
I mean,
yeah. Wine? Hey.
But it's, I couldn't recommend, I mean, someone like you, John, who's I couldn't recommend it more highly to just go to places like Hill Country in Texas,
just
south of Austin, which is the second leading wine tourism region in America,
is
besides Napa and Sonoma. Yeah.
Wow.
And they make great wines down there. Like, Texas is really doing it. But even the places like Virginia, you know, Pennsylvania, Finger Lakes, obviously, in New York. But anybody that's into wine, I really recommend going around the country.
That'd be fun because, you know, wine is one of those things that can be taken very seriously. And honestly, I'm probably lean more towards that side of, like, you know, I'm into like some, you know, serious wines that from some of what I think are some of the best producers in the world. But, you know, it can also just be a little more fun and lighthearted and doesn't have to be taken so seriously. And I would imagine that's probably a little bit more of that approach in some of those parts, in some of those areas you're talking about.
Now, how much of a help is it to be a wine connoisseur in your business? Because let's face it, people that are buying these, we're sitting in front of a magnificent, we'll go check out the video at the Imbiber. You'll see this wine cellar that we're sitting in front of right now, or we're sitting in. And how much of a help is that to you to be able to talk intelligently with these people
about
wine?
That's a great
wine.
Question. So I often talk to agents on my team that I have the opportunity to mentor, that everybody has their superpower, right? You have to find out what yours is. For example, we have some kids on our team that are amazing golfers. That's a superpower. Because if you can get out there and really hit the ball, that person that you're playing with, they don't care what your bank account is. They don't care about anything else than the fact that you can hit the ball and we can get along because there's commonality there. My superpower is wine. It's food and wine, right? That's just where I'm sort of at my best, is over, you know, a really great meal with a wonderful bottle of wine, and that's me in my sort of comfort zone. So I strive for those opportunities. I seek out those opportunities to take clients out for nice dinners, to take trips to Napa with clients, because, you know, you can look, a lot of my business is just building rapport with people, right? Rapport equates to trust, and all of that stems from commonality. So that's one commonality I try to find. And the reality is, not to stereotype, but most people that can afford this kind of house are going to be into food, wine, and travel, which are three of my biggest passions.
Yeah. Well, you, do you ever just show up when you're meeting a client and have, you know, say just a rare bottle of wine?
I bring a bottle of wine everywhere I go. I'll bring a bottle of wine to the gym. I come prepared. I'll always have wine. Because in California, you have, you know, corkage essentially anywhere you go, with the exception of a couple of restaurants, which is amazing. And when you go to other parts of the country and you see that you're not allowed to bring your own wine, I wouldn't even know what to do there, because so much of that wine, again, you want to have on the right occasion, which is usually like a special occasion, a birthday or an anniversary. You're not eating at home. You want to eat at a restaurant. You want that ambiance. You want the Michelin-starred chef. You want all of that. So I love to bring wine wherever I go and just share it with people. Wine's meant to be shared.
It is.
And it's meant to be enjoyed with food. That's one of the other sort of misconceptions about wine is, you know, it wasn't until like 20 or 30 years ago you could just go to a bar and order a glass of wine as a quote-unquote cocktail, right? It was literally created to be paired with food. You don't even really know what you're drinking unless you have something to pair it with and balance it with. So, I don't know. Again,
so what
like
would you
to
do with
to,
this? What would you do with this Chardonnay?
You could do any number of things with this. The first thing that comes to mind would be like a stone fruit and burrata kind of salad. That would be delicious with this.
Perfect.
That sounds good.
A nice white fish would go well with this.
Delicious as well. I like it. Now I want to go back to something I thought of when we were talking about, you talk about the real estate here.
Yeah.
Ash, you live in Chattanooga.
Yep.
What would be like the most expensive home in Chattanooga, if you had to guess?
Well, we just had one sell. I think it was 15,000, maybe, or 15 million. 15,000. It was a real
15,000.
Really spectacular.
I thought that was square
feet. Okay.
We had a gorgeous modern home that recently sold, and it was upwards of, you know, I don't know, 15 million, 20 million. I'll have to look it up, but gorgeous. But it's only one. Only one.
So. That's it.
Yeah.
It's the only.
Actually, it was Olin Mills, the photographer.
Oh, really?
That was his family that had created it. So it was spectacular. The lighting was gorgeous, obviously.
Right.
But yeah, it was an anomaly.
I mean, look, that's why they always talk about the three, you know, principles of real estate are location, 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 right? You take a $10 million house in Beverly Hills, you pick up that house, you drop it in the middle of the desert. It's no longer worth $10 million, right? It's all about everything. Real estate is a hyper location specific business.
Yeah. And I mean, and where we're sitting right now is
the center of
top
the bullseye.
Five in the world, I guess.
Sure.
Most valuable.
The absolute
location.
Center
I mean,
of the bullseye.
I used to live in, it's funny, we'll tie this back to wine. I lived in Aspen for a while. And my first experience ever, it's so bad, with a really good wine.
Mm-hmm.
This story is probably going to make you ill.
We're
out partying. We don't give a shit, right? Like, I don't know anything. I'm in my 20s. I don't know anything about wine, you know. And with a friend of mine and his father, I'm not going to say the name because you would know who it is. He's a famous person. And he lived on Red Mountain.
Okay.
So if anybody that knows Aspen, you've got Aspen Mountain where you ski on one side, and then there's town, and then on the other side is Red Mountain, which is where the captains of the universe have homes, right? So we went to his house.
Titans of industry.
Yeah. We went to his dad's house. And we were, you know, 20 sheets to the wind at this point.
Yep.
We had two young ladies that we met out of them. We're like, we're trying, let's
Why
go.
Not?
And he said, let's go, let's get some wine. And I don't know if I've ever even had wine. You know, I was like, that's how unsophisticated I was. And he said, yeah, my dad's got this cellar.
Oh, God.
So we go down to the cellar, and he said, I said, what can we do? What can we have? He goes, take anything. And I go, nah, dude. And he goes, no, let's do this one. Let's find the dustiest one.
Right.
And so he did. Oh, you're going
to. Must be no one wants
you're gonna, it. You're going to shit when you hear what we opened. So this would have been 20, 30, or 25 years ago. It was in 1945.
Uh-huh.
Mouton Rothschild.
Wow.
Opened it, probably drank a glass or two, and left it on the table.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Criminal.
Wow.
Criminal. Should take you out back and shoot you for that.
I'm serious.
Yeah. Oh, my God.
It was
God.
So, like, and I only remember the, I don't even, like, I remembered, like, how do you say it? And I asked somebody the next day, and that's why it stuck in my head. I wouldn't have normally even remembered the name right. of the wine, but I was like, what's Mouton? And I remember Rothschild. I go, like, that sure. sounds rich. You know?
Yeah.
So, what is that? And somebody, and I told somebody the next day, and they were just like, what?
Criminal.
What?
Yeah, sacrilege.
And that's how it all began.
Right. Yes.
The only thing that made that story worse is if you would have said that you then poured Coca-Cola in it, and then I would have actually gotten up and left.
It was Aspen. It might have been a different kind. What did you say? You said Coca-Cola?
Yeah.
Oh, no. I wrote in my first book that the ATMs in Aspen spit out rolled up 20s. Like when you go, yeah, that's how they came out. And on that note, why don't we take a quick break? And then we're going to come back with John and Ash, and we're going to try a little bit of red wine.
Great.
And hear a little bit. We'll get a little bit more into the show. I want to talk about some specifics there.
Sure.
So we'll take a quick commercial break. We'll be right back.
Friends, I made a resolution to be a better me in 2023. One of the many ways I intend to do so is by being the very best home bartender I can be. Thing is, among my other big resolutions are don't waste time and don't waste money. Let's face it, whipping up cocktails at home can be an expensive and time-consuming effort. I don't always have time to go out and get fruits and veggies and squeeze them and juice them, or at least I don't anyway, and that's why my refrigerator is always well-stocked with Fresh Victor. Fresh Victor is a line of all natural, clean-label cocktail mixers that taste splendiferous. They offer 9 unique blends with contemporary flavors designed to tantalize any palate, including the 2 newest flavors, strawberry and lemon, and grapefruit and sea salt. All of the ingredients are fair trade sourced. There's no artificial anything. The mixers are produced at a 100% solar-powered juicing plant with absolutely no waste. And right now, Fresh Victor is ready to help you be your best cocktail-making you. With a killer deal. Simply go to freshvictor.com, fill up your shopping cart, and at checkout, enter promo code FVDAN20. FV for Fresh Victor, Dan, my name, 20. FVDAN20. Get 20% off your order. How's that for a sweet deal to begin the new year? Now's the time to treat yourself to the very best mixers on the market. And that's Fresh Victor.
When the only sound is the frozen silence of winter, you go to work, throwing mountains of snow back into the sky. And when the track becomes a railroad again, it's Miller time. Time to head for the best tasting beer you can find, Miller High Life.
If you've got the time, we've got the beer.
Miller Beer.
Miller Beer.
Sir.
We're back with John Grauman, Ash McHugh, Dan Dunn. You know that, though. And we are in Bel Air, rarefied air. We're high up.
Yeah.
The view's amazing.
Yeah.
You got to have the view, right? I mean, every property that I saw on buying Beverly Hills pretty much had it.
Having awesome a big view is definitely going to command a huge premium, but so does flat land. Right? I mean, if you think about it, anytime you're in an elevated position, which is, say, in the hills, you're going to have some kind of a view. The quality of that view is going to vary. But the hardest thing to find in the hills is actually flat land. So if you can find a flat pad with a big view in the hills, that's, you know, that's the trifecta.
Okay.
Yeah.
I want to get into the geeky stuff a little bit about the show, like how it works. So how real estate works. You have a team and you work and you're at the agency. How does all this, because a lot of people are always coming to each other and going, oh, I got this list. I mean, everybody seems to be working together. How do you split the money, the commission? Like if someone brings you, okay, who's the guy, Joey, that's on the show? So he was selling his aunt's property.
Yeah.
But somebody else, one of the other guys came in and was helping him. And
yeah.
Does he get a taste or
yeah,
no?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So just brass tacks, there's two sides to every deal. Right, there is the listing broker that represents the seller, and then there is the selling broker, more commonly known as the buyer's agent, that of course then represents the buyer. There's a commission that's going to be offered on every deal. That commission gets paid to the listing broker, who then splits that commission with the cooperating broker, mm-hmm. the buyer's agent. Okay, so let's just say there's a 5% commission going to be paid, which is industry standard. Then they're going to be 2.5% to one side, 2.5% to the other.
Okay.
Right, so each side has their own representation.
So with, if one of your junior agents,
yeah.
I'm trying to, I just watched the whole
Sonica,
thing.
Sonica, Brandon.
Yeah. Okay, they sell a home. You're getting a taste of that as well?
Yeah. Okay. I mean, not to get too granular here, but it depends on the origin of that deal. So if I'm giving them that lead and I'm just asking them to go service it, then they're going to take a small cut of it. If they originate it through their own sphere of influence and their own, you know, grit and efforts, then they're going to take a bigger cut of that.
Okay. And how much does being on a show, such as Buying Beverly Hills, impact doing your actual job? Does it help? Does it hinder? What?
It impacted during filming. I mean, it was no joke because we filmed that show in roughly 2 months. I mean, there was a handful of like pickup days and pickup shoots that followed in the months that followed. But for the most part, we filmed 90% of that show in 2 months, which means we were filming, you know, 2, 3, 4 days a week. So it impacted it in that respect. And then obviously since it's come out, it's just been nothing but a positive impact. It's just still surreal to me. I mean, like, this is my first time ever being on a show like this. And I remember like the week after it came out, I was at a charity event and I'm walking through this crowd of people and I walk past this guy and he looks at me and he goes, "Those eyebrows need their own office." And I was like, what? This guy's quoting the show to me?
You
like,
do have amazing eyebrows. And somebody made a remark about it.
That's
on
my
the
point.
Show.
It's from that line in the show where he's like, you know, something about my eyebrows being iconic and needing their own office, which like, guys, I'm just doing the best I can with what I was given. Like if I didn't trim them, it would be like, you know, a headband. Like this is, you know, I do the best I can with what I got.
Good eyebrows. And then I saw you today and I'm like, oh.
No, I feel left out. I've got shitty eyebrows, don't I?
No,
you can say it.
No, we could.
Can we fix them though?
You got.
I mean, I can see. I'm definitely pulling up the rear here in the eyebrow cat. You guys could be eyebrow models.
Yeah, you do have really good eyebrows.
Thank you.
They're really well. Yeah, thank they're really well sculpted.
Yes, every day a little bit of a. Twist
me too. That's it. I've never had my eyebrows done.
No, I do it myself.
Exactly.
Right. I know exactly how they need to be. Cheers.
All right,
to that.
Let's cheers to the eyebrows. Get here. And what we're drinking now, we've moved on to red wine. We're doing a KJ Vintners Reserve California Pinot Noir 2021. This is a 91 point wine enthusiast. It's 100% Pinot Noir, $20 a bottle. It's a value wine. What do you think?
Yeah, it's a good buy. Yeah. It's good. I mean, obviously going to be lighter, brighter fruits, lots of cherry notes in there. I like it.
Yeah, I'm getting a little black cherry.
It's easy.
Yeah, you definitely
right
get
off that. I'm getting
notes.
That. A little bit of on the nose, I got a little burnt toast thing going. Did you get that?
I don't know, but I can revisit.
Let's try it. Yeah.
I like it. I think it's really easy to drink.
I think, yeah. And
I mean, I could have a couple, three of these.
You could. Yeah. Well,
glasses or bottles.
Yeah.
Right. Exactly.
So the wine's great. Now I want to get back to the, so now you've got these, do your junior agents get ahead? Like, do they get a little bit of big head on them now? Cause they're on a TV show. Do you have to deal with any of that stuff post production or post show airing?
Maybe with some, not with the ones on my team. We have a really amazing group of people. It's a solid culture that, like, we're not letting anyone, you know, get too big for the bridges, myself included, by the way.
Yeah.
No, it's look, it's a great opportunity and it's great exposure, but, like, at the end of the day, we sell houses.
Yeah.
Right? Like, I was at a restaurant, a beautiful restaurant in Montecito with my wife for her birthday a few weeks ago. And, you know, this is a world-class kind of restaurant. And the waiter who's serving us, and this is our, you know, again, career, like professional waiters, for like 3 hours, this guy waits on us, does the most amazing job. And at the end, he comes over and he goes, "So how's being famous treating you?" And I was like, the fact that he even recognized me blew my mind. But I just looked at him and I was like, dude, I just sell houses. Like, I mean, it's amazing that we got to portray it on television for the whole world to see. But like...
Well, how do they determine who... Oh, go ahead, Ash.
No, you come across so authentic. That's your
Thank
first
you.
Impression of when we meet. And that's rare, especially in this town. But you are. You are just authentic. And I think you bring the elevation to the show.
I appreciate that. Yeah. Look, the reality is we deal in very high price points. Those high price points have big commission checks attached to them. And as a result, you know, there are some agents out there that just kind of think that they're the star of the show, so to speak. That it's about them when it's not. So rule number one.
You're
about
talking about Ben, right?
I'm not specifically talking about anyone. Super, super clear.
I know who you're talking about. John's not saying that. I'm saying that.
But you know, they tend to make it about themselves. And again, we have a lot of, you know, newer agents like Brandon and Sonica that we have the opportunity to mentor and groom. And I always sit down with each one of them and say, rule number one: take yourself out of it. This isn't about you. has nothing to do with you. You're merely a conduit. You are here to help shepherd these people from steps A to B to C in what is oftentimes a very daunting and one of the most important decisions of their lives. But it's not about you. And I think people get a little bit too wrapped up in the ego of it. Mm. So yes, thank you for that. We try to stay super grounded.
How did they determine who was go? So you mentioned your wife. Your wife also works. There's not really on the show though.
No.
How do they determine who was going? Was that casting, or did Mauricio say this is who I want on the show, or how did that work?
We casted for it, which again is just sort of. If you're not like a paid actor that goes out on auditions, just being casted is a weird experience. It's just a foreign one, I would say. So yeah, everybody had to go out and cast for it, and then how they selected them. Honest to God, I have no idea. I think that I probably got selected to provide the house porn, right?
I think it's the eyebrows.
The eyebrows don't hurt. But, you know, I also know that, like, or at least I think, they probably looked at me and were like, he's probably a little too polished. Like, he's not going to say anything outlandish. He's not going to throw anyone in the pool or throw wine in someone's face, which I'm not. But, you know, I think that they also wanted to kind of elevate what real estate reality shows are known as, and, like, let's, you know, inject a little professionalism in here. And then let's show the big, beautiful houses.
Well, everybody... I guess this is just the norm for that bit, but everybody's good looking. Right? Everybody on the show is, you know, there's...
I would imagine casting probably had some say in that as well. Yes, but, I would imagine the casting director probably
But I mean,
had,
even the people in the background that weren't on the show, everybody looks... I mean, I guess you're selling an image, though, too, right?
It's a good-looking industry. It really is.
Ugly. I mean, look at this. We want pretty, pretty, pretty. Hot, right?
The other thing is, I mean, think about this. So... You know, LA is obviously is a melting pot of people that come from all over the world. Most people come here with a different sort of agenda or objective in mind. They want to be an actor. They want to be a model. They want to be something in that arena. What do most of them end up doing? Bartending, waiting tables, right? Because they're trying to make
podcasting.
It. Podcasting, yeah. Sure. And real estate is another one of those industries, unfortunately, because there's too low of a bar for entry that a lot of people are like, oh, I take this online test and here's my license and boom, I'm a fiduciary. Great, I'll do that. So... You get a lot of sort of part-time and transient agents, which unfortunately gives us that sort of negative stigma of, you know, the used car salesman, which we try to, you know, separate ourselves from. But you also get some really beautiful people is the point.
Well, you mentioned that, and they said in the show there were like 89% or something of real, they're out in the first
87% are out in the first 2 years.
Yeah, wow. Done. So what is, let's, you mentioned your family, but what was your background? Because there was, on the show, somebody mentioned... You had a musical, by the way. Yeah. You were in the music biz. So
not musical. I'm not. I'm the
you were
furthest
in music,
thing from musical.
You were roadie, yes. And you did. So yeah. How did you? Tell us a little bit about that, and then how did you make the transition to real estate?
Yeah. So believe it or not, I started as a rave promoter.
Raves.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh yeah, that's right. They did. They showed that on the show.
I mean, again, like I'm keenly aware of like what I look like. I see my reflection in the mirror every day. I know it doesn't sort of match the image, which comes off sort of polished now. But I was a rave promoter. I was that kid standing on a street corner passing out flyers and throwing parties. And this is like the mid-90s. This is when we're still like in underground illegal warehouses. So, you know, back then I was working with a guy named Pasquale Rotella, who now who owns a company called Insomniac, mm-hmm. who does EDC, Electric Daisy Carnival, and the biggest festivals
Huge festivals on planet Earth.
And back then him and I were, you know, throwing these parties in the late 90s that were still really big for the time. You know, we had... 10, 12, 15,000 people, which back then was...
Who were the DJs? Were you like Paul Oakenfold type? Or is
Oakie hadn't really made it here yet. He kind of came out in like the early 2000s. This was more like, and we hadn't even seen that British invasion yet. So it was really the local guys. It was DJ Dan. It was Donald Glaude. It was Christopher Lawrence. It was...
I wonder if you would know this guy. I grew up in Philly, yeah. As we talked about. And two guys that used to be at our local bar, a place called Zero. And they both went on to become Josh Wink. Who became like, one day I pick up Rolling Stone and I'm like, there's Josh. And I'm like, what the hell? And he's getting like $1 million to play. Yeah. And then King Britt. And King Britt went into Diggable Planets.
Yeah.
And
Josh Wink was a legend because he produced a track called Higher State of Consciousness that at the time was just like, and it's so funny. You go back and listen to it now.
Wait, these songs have names?
Yeah.
I've been to raves and I'm like, to me, it's just one long song. Like, probably because I was on a ton of E at the time, but I'm like, this is the greatest song I've ever heard. The one song that I heard the whole night. Yeah.
Yeah. No, believe it or not, they're actually separate tracks. And anyways, Wink was, you know, a legend back then. The other guys that Diesel Boy is a huge guy out of Philly that I signed. Nigel Richards was a big guy out of Philly.
Well, then they started 611 Records, right?
That's
weren't
that's
a lot
Nigel.
Of the DJs.
Yeah, yeah.
That,
yeah,
okay.
Yeah. There you go.
Yeah. Wow.
Do you miss those days?
Yes,
terribly.
Yes.
Is it that obvious?
Yes,
yeah.
Yes,
yeah.
Now I'm ready to like,
I
where
do.
Are we going?
I mean,
let's
you know,
go.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like,
it's Friday
I actually,
night.
Look, it's been, I'm so far removed from it at this point. I actually have to remind myself that like the memories in my head were memories that I actually lived, not just like a film that I watched, right? That like you have
crazy,
to kind of be like,
right?
Oh yeah, 25 years ago, I did yeah. that. Can we swear on this?
Oh, you can say whatever you want.
Oh, great. Yeah, okay. So I've been like whispering it.
So
yeah.
Are there moments when you're changing diapers? You got two kids.
Yeah.
When you're changing diapers going, I remember.
Another life.
We changed it. I remember I used to be.
No, when I'm changing the diapers, it's usually, how did I end up here?
That's what I mean. Like going,
how did
man.
This,
like,
how am I here
the,
yeah, right
not
now?
That, not that, obviously, love your kids, but
yeah. I'm not suggesting
I don't have
I don't
any
love
kids.
My kids. Yeah.
Ash has,
yeah,
Ash has a son.
Yeah.
And there must be, I always wonder with my friends that have kids, is that moment when you go, it's over.
Yeah.
I'm never going to another rave again. I'm never, you know.
Yeah, my wife and I have those moments all the time because, and we always think about like, what would our life be right now if we had kids? Because when we met, so my wife and I met in 2011, right? We were coming off the heels of the mortgage crisis. And keep in mind, I'm skipping way ahead in what, my career, but I was a mortgage broker in the early 2000s. And I was a mortgage broker during the mortgage crisis, which was essentially like having a front row seat for the end of the world.
So let me stop you there. How did that, how did the jump from, did you just have a moment when you're like, I'm not, this isn't going to be my future?
No. So, okay. So I'll go backwards and then I'll come back to the poopy diapers in a second. Yeah. So, rave promoter, produced a big event in LA that attracted the attention of a record label. Record label comes and offers me a job as the A&R guy. I literally didn't even know what A&R meant. I had to go Google. Actually, there wasn't Google then. I had to go ask somebody, what is A&R? It's artists and repertoire. Right. You're the guy responsible for signing the artists and then cultivating those relationships. So I did that for a few years. And then, you know, 2002, 2003 hit, which if you remember what that was in the music industry, that was the dawn of Napster. Music pirating, CD burning, file sharing. The record industry imploded. I mean, it was unbelievable. It happened like that. And people were getting laid off by the thousands. And sadly, I was one of them. So I got an opportunity to go out on tour. I just signed Mixmaster Mike from the Beastie Boys.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
He asked me to go out as his tour manager.
Playing, I don't know if you know that. There's a place in Venice where I live, 3 blocks from my house, and we should go. He's playing the Venice West next month. Mixmaster Mike is playing.
Unreal.
Venice.
If
you got to go, man. Venice West. I think it's in February.
I'm flying back out for it.
Yeah. Ash's invited.
He's cute. Like, I've seen the Beastie Boys, and I'm like, how is it? You'll love it. It's a little bar.
Oh, awesome. Okay. All right. We'll connect on that. Yeah, no. So Mike got asked to go on tour with Guns N' Roses, which is the most unlikely of pairings. I didn't know, like, what? Mixmaster Mike opening for Guns? Unless you've toured with Guns, because Axl is notorious for coming on at minimum an hour, 2 hours late every night, and you can't exactly ask the opening band to just
keep playing.
Can you just play another track, play another song? But you can't ask a DJ to play another record, play another record, play another record. So that's what we ended up doing every night. So from there, anyways, I got linked up with Ozzy, and I got linked up with Manson, and I just ended up touring for like a year and a half. And just saw the writing on the walls and was like, I was like 22, 23. And I'm like, I'm not doing this for the next 40 years of my life.
So wait, you're 22. So how old were you when you started in the rave?
I was 17.
Jesus.
Yeah. The first party I threw, I was 17. And I know this because the party got broken up. I think the posted capacity was like 900 and we had like 1600 or 1700 people in there. So they called the fire marshal. I come outside and it is literally, I mean, you have 2 blocks that are completely blocked off with like helicopters up above, cops in riot gear, ambulances, fire trucks, the whole nine. My parents are there and they're looking at me going like, what the fuck have you done? And, you know, I didn't know this. If you throw an event and it gets broken up for legal reasons and they have to call out all of that support, guess who's paying for it?
You.
You are. Except they couldn't go after me because I was a minor.
Well, where did that come from? Where did that, I mean, you're 17 years old.
Yeah.
Where did you get that drive, that sense of entrepreneurship to be, because when I was 17, I was not thinking, I think I might have thrown in Philly, they used to call them beef and beers. You could rent a hall out and you get kegs of beer and you charge like $10 a person and you say it's for charity and you keep the money, right? You know, but that was about as ambitious as I got. Where did that come from? Where you just were, was that just something that was ingrained in you?
Yeah, I've always just kind of been ambitious. I've always just sort of wanted to just kind of what's next.
You had a lemonade stand at 10.
I'm sure probably, if you asked my mom, I probably did. Yeah, so I didn't graduate high school. I got my GED and decided that I wanted to just go straight into the workforce. High school just wasn't for me. And one of the positive outlets that I found was the rave scene, and I just took to it. It was just a very warm, inviting community, and as soon as I saw how the dots are connected, I just thought, well, I could throw one of these. Let's throw one of these. It was more just about doing something with your buds. It was more just about having fun. I don't know that I was
ambitious. So you were tied in with the cool kids, though. Then you had Pete, because you have to know people to get them to come to your thing, right?
And then you got to, yeah, but then you got to go raise capital, right? Then you got to raise money. I mean, these parties weren't costing millions, but back then, you know, it was probably 10, 20, 30 grand, but that was millions to me when I'm, you know, 17 years old. So
how'd you raise the money?
Just, again, through like, people, I'm going to say like older people we know, they were probably like in their mid-20s, right? That like thought it'd be cool to, you know, be the financial older investor people. Of a rave. And like,
by the way, do you ever walk into a property like this and go, man, the rave I could throw here?
I walk into almost every property and go, the gig would go there.
Yeah. I mean, I was looking, I mean, this house is spectacular. I mean, yeah. But the one you were talking about that was the $149 million home.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm looking at that going, they had a nightclub.
Yeah.
A full-blown nightclub in the house. And just going, how fun would that be?
There's a house up here in Bel Air, not far from here, that my partners James and David sold last year, that you walk into the living room, and there's this platform that's totally flush with the floor, but then it raises up, and a DJ booth comes out of the floor and raises up like 10 feet high, and it turns the whole place into a club.
That's insane.
It's wild. It's wild.
Wow.
We're going to move on to our last wine. Yes, sir. Although we could sit here and talk to you all day, John. I mean, we'll be hanging out at the Mixmaster Mike thing, right? You're going to fly back out for that, Ash?
I am. Yeah. Absolutely.
I mean, how
my son's first song.
They got to be spinning.
Yeah, Sabotage.
I'll just drink it out of the bottle.
Yeah, get it.
Yeah, perfect. Okay,
oh, do you want to dump into that glass there?
Yeah, or we have two glasses there.
Or just grab those, or yeah.
Yeah, you can just dump it in there.
I've reached the point where you guys are on your own now. Like earlier in the show, I was just pouring. So the wine we're having now is.
Get one more. There?
One more, yeah. Is the Hawkeye Mountain Cabernet Sauvignon from Kendall Jackson, a 2019 from Alexander Valley, which is in Sonoma County. We all know that.
Yep.
This is 100% Cabernet Sauvignon, 14.5% alcohol, which they're lying about. No, I'm kidding. Whenever you see 14.5% in California, it's got to be at least 15, right? Don't you think? Kind of. They like the big
air?
They like the big ABVs, and you know, we talked earlier about, you know, that Mouton Rosso.
Cheers.
Those wines tend to be more in around 11%. But I've come to really love California Cabernet. How about you?
That's my passion. I mean, first of all, speaking to your point, yes, we have warmer climates up here. Warmer climates produce more sugar. More sugar is going to equate to a higher alcohol content. So that's why it's going to be 14, 15% versus, say, 11% in, like, Burgundy. But yes, I'm, again, born and raised here. My dad started taking me to Napa when I was a teenager. I've been going there my whole life.
Quickly, so everybody knows, if you're out there listening, you want to get this $70 a bottle for this one, okay? What was your aha moment? Like, when was the moment that you went, yeah, wine's going to be a big part of my life?
My dad took me up to Napa when I was 15. We were having lunch at a restaurant called Etoile, which is a restaurant that's no longer open, but it was at Domaine Chandon. And we're sitting out on the terrace overlooking the beautiful garden and the vineyards, and my dad orders a bottle of sparkling wine. And the waiter comes over and he looks at me and he goes, "You're 21, right?" And I go, "Yeah, of course." And he goes, "And I asked for your ID. You showed it to me, didn't you?" I said, "Yeah, obviously." And he goes, "Okay, it's good enough for me." And my dad and I sat out there for the next like 2 hours and drank through this bottle. And it was just, I don't know, it was just a really eye-opening experience, and just I just developed a passion for it. And in my wine cellar at home, my most treasured collection in my wine cellar is not actually a bottle. It is that cork from that day. I still have it in my wine cellar.
Well, this speaks to what we talked about earlier, because I watched how you lit up.
Moments.
Yeah, you lit up talking about that.
Yeah, and I felt it.
You're never going to forget that bottle, because it's you and your dad, you know, sitting out there, and like, that's a memory that'll stay with you forever.
Yeah, and my passion has now far exceeded his, which is really fun. So for his 70th birthday, I surprised him by flying him to Napa, took him to the French Laundry, took him to Promontory, which is owned by Harlan, and took him to like some of like the most world-renowned wineries you could possibly imagine. And to get to be on the other side of that relationship now and get to take him and treat him and sort of share these experiences with him is everything.
That's great.
Yeah, it's awesome.
That's what we're here for.
That's right.
These kinds of experiences.
I'll tell you this. So I wasn't raised religious. My parents raised me with a very simple belief. There are two kinds of people in this world. There are those that eat to live, and there are those that live to eat. And never forget that we're the latter.
Yeah.
I remember my parents just ingrained that in me, that like we are here to eat good food and drink good wine with our favorite people. That's what we're here to do.
My mom was like, hey, what do you want for dinner tonight? Kraft macaroni and cheese or a cheesesteak? Philly cheese, because that's what we're having. There are two options on the table here. Mine, I mentioned earlier, Verite.
Yeah.
Pierre Celan is the world famous winemaker for Verite. And I really, that was my, he came down, this was probably 15 years ago, and we were at the Viceroy in Santa Monica, and he tasted me through these Verite wines. And that was the moment I went, oh boy, look what I've been missing.
Yeah.
You know, like we just go, this is something else, you know, and we had some food come out, and it's like you said, I mean, it's just this beautiful thing that was developed to complement food.
Yeah.
And
anyone that says, I don't like wine, my response is you haven't tried enough of it yet. Because nobody could try all the different wines out there and come away from it saying, yes, sir, I don't like any of that. There's rivers of great wine. There's oceans of great wine out there. And when you get to experience wine on a world-class level like you did in that moment, you go, oh my God, wow. I didn't even know that like that part of the world existed that now I've opened myself up to. It's a very expensive hobby, but it's a really fun one.
You talk about the world. Oh, go ahead.
I was going to say that too, the cultivation of such fancy luxury, but the other side of the industry is hardworking, gritty, dirty, handsy. And I love that.
Yeah.
I mean, and that's the beauty, is it's two sides to each coin.
Yeah. And I don't even know if we're talking about real estate or wine, because it could be the same about both.
Well, exactly.
Right? Because winemaking is farming. It's tough. It's gritty. Yeah. It's all the things you just said. It's not like, you know, it's easy to sort of like romanticize it when you go to a winery and you're seeing the finished product poured in a glass in front of you. But that's not what winemaking is. It's farming.
Yep.
It's getting up at the crack of dawn and being out before the sun rises.
Absolutely. Yeah. And one of the things too, I love it. And it maybe for me more spirits is kind of more my forte, I guess. Yeah. I mean, I know a lot about wine, but, and you'll get older spirits, but when you start looking at some of the collector wines, do you ever think about the fact that sometimes you're drinking a wine, you're like, probably most of the people that made this thing aren't here anymore. This is their legacy. Like, this is the thing. And again, I'll say that a lot more, like you'll get that more in like scotch. If you're drinking a 60-year-old scotch, everybody that made that's dead, right? You know, but with a wine, you know, if you drink a wine that was, you know, made in the 60s,
right,
the winemaker's gone.
Yeah.
Probably the people that were farming the land, they're all gone. Yet this, they live on.
Yeah.
You're drinking the legacy of these people.
Yeah. I hadn't really thought about it that
way.
That's
the heaviest thing
that
I've ever said.
That is, yeah. Dan, that was
deep. That's the most profound thing you're ever going to get out of me. Yeah,
you touched me deep.
You'll see when we're at Mixmaster Mike and I'm fucking spinning around on
just
the dance floor.
Like,
this idiot,
about, yeah.
This idiot said that? Yeah. Well, let me ask you this before we let you go, because we do got to let you go. But you mentioned the world, the ocean of wine, as you put it. Where have you done much wine tourism outside of the United States? Where have you gone? And what are your, like, favorite spots where you've gone?
Yeah, so my wife and I, just for context, we got engaged in Napa, we got married in Paso Robles, and we honeymooned in Bordeaux. So that was a nice little leg right there. Bordeaux was great, but really more for the historical element, right? Just because you're sort of at, like, I don't know, it feels sort of like the epicenter of.
So where did you go? Did you go to like Margaux or any of those places? Did you hit any of the...
No, we went to Ponte Canet.
Okay.
And then we toured, you know, some smaller boutique wineries in Saint-Emilion and Pomerol.
Yep.
We were in Tuscany last summer, so that was fun.
Isn't that the... I mean, I love France. I really do. But there's something about Tuscany. Like,
Tuscany is special.
It's just so gorgeous.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, it's very special. But honest to God, my favorite wine region is Napa. And I genuinely believe that the best wine on the planet comes out of Napa. I really do. And I know that's a bold statement. And I know a lot of people would, you know, think
Napa,
that
Sonoma too, or are you just saying Napa, just Napa?
I'm going to go more on the Napa side. Because again, if you're going to Sonoma, you're really kind of competing against mostly Pinots. And I'm not going to put some of those Pinots up against some stuff that's coming from Burgundy. But in terms of like Bordeaux varietals, right? If you're looking at like the same wines that we've produced in Bordeaux, Saint-Emilion, Pomerol that come out of Napa, first of all, it's not a fair comparison, New World versus Old World, because it's not a fair fight, right? We get to self-irrigate. We get to blend differently. There's a lot of more restrictions over there that just doesn't make it a fair, balanced fight. But if you're just looking at what that tasting experience is, I'm sorry, the best wine in the world comes out of Napa.
You heard it here. Look at that, Ash.
There we go. We've
what do you think?
It. I'll like never it. Be invited
you know
back
where
the
to be. You know where the best wine in the world does not come from? Chattanooga.
No, sadly.
I'm going to say the Tennessee, with all due respect to Tennessee, not a great wine region.
Choo-choo winery, no.
Good music, good music.
I don't know much about Chattanooga.
Cowboy boots and stuff.
Fried chicken, we got that.
Fried chicken. Yeah, is that your thing?
Fried chicken? And some green
beans. What is Chattanooga known for? Food? Is that it?
But here's a little fact. Chattanooga has the fastest internet in America. Who knew?
Are you serious right now?
Yes.
Gig City. And this is what, like, that's, you guys have that on bumper stickers? Or
we
like
do.
Okay.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, you know why they need it to be Google speedy, so when people are Googling, how do I get the fuck out of Chattanooga? They get an answer quickly. Kidding.
Y'all come visit.
What are we known for? Philly. What would it? Well, cheesesteaks.
Cheesesteaks.
And tasty cakes. And
I don't know, tasty cakes. But
violence at sporting events.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Yeah.
Some harsh fans.
We'll see. By the time this show ends, so we're taping this 2 days before the NFC Championship.
Yeah.
Hopefully, when you're listening to this, you're going, man, Dan's lucky his Eagles are going to the Super Bowl. And if they're not,
well, I think you guys got this.
Next episode, we'll be crying.
Yeah. I think you guys got this.
Are you a sports fan?
I'm a huge sports fan.
Who's your team?
Patriots.
Oh, that's right. Yeah. You mentioned that.
So my uncle was...
How did that happen?
My uncle was the offensive line coach for the Patriots for 33 years. So, I mean, it was ingrained in me. It's like, you know...
Did he work under Belichick, too?
Or? Oh, yeah. Yeah, you know, he just retired. He retired the same year that Brady left. When Brady left to Tampa Bay, they had sort of made a pact. Because, again, he coached Brady's O-line. So when they kind of made a pact that, like, look, I'm here as long as you're here. So when Brady left, my uncle,
am I imagining this? Did this happen on the show? Because, again, it was in a freak binge of buying Beverly Hills. Did somebody say that, did you guys sell Brady's house? Was that on the show, or did somebody else tell
you?
No,
we didn't.
You didn't? Okay. I could have sworn somebody said that you guys.
No, he had a place here in Brentwood that he sold to Dr. Dre probably 6-7 years ago, maybe. Maybe longer now. But no, sadly, not involved in that one. Love to, though.
Right?
Yeah, that's my boy.
So what's the final thing before we go? What is your... You know, you're doing well, you're on TV, you're making money selling real estate. Do you ever think to yourself, I'd like to have my own winery someday?
Yes.
Because you mentioned it earlier, and when you said it, I saw a little twinkle in your eyes.
Do you ever
think to yourself, I'm going to do this? Like, would your wife want to do that as well?
Oh, for sure, yeah. My wife isn't as passionate about it as I am, but she's a really great passenger. She's happy to go along for any ride. It would be a passion project for us. It would never be something that I would
small
want to say.
Like, you're looking at like a boutique 100%. Thing.
This is a, like, I've gotten to a place in my life where I can dabble in this for fun and not be concerned about turning a profit because I'm not looking to, like, build a career on it, but rather to just, I don't know. I think it would be something great, a great legacy to use.
Could you imagine sitting at your winery, at your tasting room with the wine you made, or if you bring in a winemaker, but it's your wine? And just pouring for people and being like, what do you think? That's got
to
be such a...
I sold a house to some clients of mine that lived down here but bought a place up in Napa a couple years ago. And it was such a great situation. They had the house and then 2 acres of planted mature Cabernet that they already had a contract to sell it to a top producer up there. I won't say who. And the contract came up for renegotiation. And as part of their renegotiation, they said, we will make 2 cases per year under your own label that you guys can have just for your friends and family. Which is so cool. Like, I mean, again, just like that little bit, like, I wouldn't need much more of a connection than that. Just to have some kind of connection to brand it with, like, my wife and I've always joked about, you know you've made it when you have a family emblem. Like, if you ever get to, like, when you have, like, a family crest,
you've made it.
Right? So we've always sort of joke about, like, what would go on a family crest.
What's from rave to wine?
From rave?
That's you.
Yeah. Actually, I do know the name already.
Wine called Raving. Raving.
Yeah. We know the name already. The name would be East Olive.
East Olive.
My son's name is East and my daughter's name is Olivia.
Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah.
That's amazing. All right, I keep saying one last thing, but there, you mentioned the wine. Why, given that you're clearly well-versed in wine, you are a wine connoisseur, why on the show does Ben, who I've mentioned earlier, why does Ben get the scene where he's quizzing his significant other on, he's tasting her through wine, and... Do you remember this part?
Yeah, of course I do. Yeah.
Why wasn't that you?
Because Ben is an actual somm.
Oh, he is.
Ben's a sommelier. Yeah.
Oh,
so
wow.
So
do you guys get together and go out?
Sure.
And,
of course. But like he always, we don't have the same palate. The way I feel about Napa wine, he does not share.
He doesn't.
So, no. He likes really interesting, obscure, complex wines. And to me, you know, wines can be one of two things. They're either going to be really smooth or really complex. And I'm getting two like generalities there, but he likes the really more obscure minerality, complex wines. I like just that lush, silky, smooth, elegant sort of wine.
Okay. Well, I can't wait to try East Olive wine someday. And I'll say,
first vintage, 2040.
I can't wait. I cannot wait. Well, listen, it's been a real thrill, John.
Likewise.
Talking to you, and thanks for inviting us into this. We're going to go play some hoop after this, Astros. Definitely. Full on basketball court in here.
I mean, when you say full basketball court,
full
just to be clear,
basketball
a full
court.
Size yeah, indoor basketball court.
We're
going to
go play
court.
Some hoops after this. Yeah. I have
I'm
a little more.
This bar room behind us.
This is it. We're going to get hit in there.
I'll see y'all in there. We'll play.
Buying Beverly Hills is on Netflix, and I'm telling you, I'm not kidding. It's in a. Once you start watching it, you're not going to stop. It's and,
we
and
hope
they're
not.
Obviously they're going to do another season. I'm guessing on this thing.
I hope so. Still no official word. Lots of mumblings and grumblings.
It was a hit. It was a hit show.
I think so.
Right?
I mean, we were top 10 in over 30 countries, but I don't know. Look, I just sell houses, as I said at the beginning. I don't know.
Look at him. Look at his false modesty over there. Ash McHugh, all the way in from Chattanooga.
Thank you,
she
much.
Did. She actually made a big effort to get
That's
here.
Really sweet.
She was supposed to go back to... Right now, you're supposed to be on a plane back right now. And I told her what I was doing, and she's been on the show before. And she said, I'd love to come do that with you. And she said, I'll change my flight just to meet you
and
to be here.
Very sweet.
Eyebrows.
Yeah, the eyebrows.
Fisherman can always spot another fisherman.
There you go.
Yeah.
Invite you to follow where they find you on the social media.
Just on Instagram, which is at John Grauman.
Where'd you come up with that?
And then also bongcollective.re.
Okay. Ash.
Ash McHugh.
Miss Ash McHugh. I'm, of course, at The Imbiber. Podcast has an IG called WWD_podcast, but we ignore that. It's me, The Imbiber. Go there and check it out. Check out the show, Buying Beverly Hills.
Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.